new from the life of Abraham. If you've been going to church all your life and you've been in Sunday school since you were a little kid and you've heard the story of Abraham many times, I still hope you've been blessed in some way by this message. If this is the first time you've ever gone through Abraham's life, I pray that it's been something useful. There's been something you can take home and apply to your lives. We're in Genesis 20 today. George was in tears as he explained to his pastor how his marriage had come to the brink of ruin. He'd been in a relationship with another woman for several months. He tried several times to break off that affair, but each time he broke his promises. In desperation, George had prayed that God would deliver him from this sin, that God would remove this desire from him. But now his double life had caught up with him. His wife discovered the affair, and she insisted that he immediately cut off all contact with her, or she would leave him. But he was afraid that he would fail, just like he had every time before. And so he was overwhelmed in guilt and fear and shame. Sandra had an explosive temper. Words flew from her mouth like bullets from a gun. If there were five ways you could say something, she could pick the most hurtful without even trying. Her anger had shattered her marriage. Her grown children resented her. Her co-workers avoided her. She'd already burned bridges at several jobs. On one particular sharp exchange, she grabbed a co-worker's cell phone, threw it against a wall, shattered it into a million pieces, and this was in front of an important client. Humiliated and guilt-ridden, Sandra vowed to change. But it didn't help. And eventually she just gave up. She said, I can't help it. This is just the way I am. Did this story sound at all familiar? Perhaps if you just changed the name, would it hit a little too close to home? And maybe the particular sin is different. But the struggle, that's the same. How many of us did something this week that at some point we swore we never would do again? How many of us watched something or read something that we said we were done with? How many of us spoke something that we vowed not to speak? You see, such struggles with sin are not uncommon. One of the terrible aspects of our sinful nature is its habit of rearing its ugly head again and again. And there have been times that I have thought, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if the moment we come up out of the waters of baptism, if at that moment our struggles with sin were done? You know, at that point that we repented of our sin, that we asked God for forgiveness, that from that moment on, no more temptation, no more broken promises to God and ourselves, no more disappointing our loved ones, no more guilt. But that's not the way it is it? Oh, yes, the moment we are saved, we are covered by the blood of Christ. From that point on, God no longer sees in us our sin. He sees in us the righteousness of His Son. But our growth in the faith, our maturity, our walk with God, that has only just begun. And we grow through some sins quite easily. We could all tell stories here this morning of things we used to do. Oh, I used to do that. Oh, I used to talk that way. I used to be involved in this. But then I found Jesus. I began my relationship with Him. And that's in the past. That's history. That's over. That's done with. Hasn't happened in years. But there are other sins that seem to plague us throughout our lives. We fight them with everything we have. We throw every ounce of willpower we have into the fight. We promise never to do it again. And we think we've achieved victory. And then we stumble. And we know how it goes. We enjoy a sinful pleasure. We feel guilty. We determine never to do it again. We take some confidence from a few moments of self-control. We think we've overcome it. And then, boom. Wash, rinse, repeat. And each time we repeat, it seems the reins of the sin's control in our lives gets a little bit stronger. And you know what? There's nothing new about this struggle. Kelly read a text this morning, a passage from Paul in Romans chapter 7, where he described that very same process working in his own life. The things I want to do, Paul says, I don't do. And the things that I don't want to do, that's what I do. And I think every single one of us has been there. And it wasn't just Paul. It's also Abraham. If you go back to Genesis 12, we looked at that passage several weeks ago. But at that point in the story, Abraham is still relatively immature in the faith. He's just arrived in the promised land. But he doesn't have a whole lot of experience with God. And a famine hits. And instead of seeking God, Abraham takes matters into his own hands. He flees down to Egypt, where there's a very powerful Egyptian pharaoh. And Abraham is concerned because his wife Sarah is a beautiful woman. An Egyptian pharaoh, he's quite accustomed to, he sees a woman he likes, he takes her. And Abraham's afraid that he's going to kill him to get to her. And so they concoct this little story, hide the fact that they're husband and wife. And he gets his wife in a lot of trouble. He gets Pharaoh in a lot of trouble. It's a big mess. But that was years ago. And Abraham has been through so much. He has grown in his faith. He has seen God prove his faithfulness again and again and again and again. And you would think by this time that sin is well back in the rearview mirror of Abraham's life. But look what happens in chapter 20, verse 1. Now Abraham moved on from there into the region of the Negev and lived between Kadesh and Shur. For a while he stayed in Gerar, and there Abraham said of his wife Sarah, "She is my sister." Then Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent for Sarah and took her. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night and said to him, "You are as good as dead because of the woman you have taken. She is a married woman." Now Abimelech had not gone near her, so he said, "Lord, will you destroy an innocent nation? Did he not say to me, 'She is my sister,' and didn't she also say, 'He is my brother'? I have done this with a clear conscience and clean hands." Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know you did this with a clear conscience. And so I have kept you from sinning against me. That is why I did not let you touch her. Now return the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not return her, you may be sure that you and all of yours will die." You see, old sins die hard. What you might think had died in Abraham years ago haunts him once again. And we see here that Abraham shares with us the same struggle with sin that many of us have. No matter how long we've been a Christian, no matter how long we've walked with God, we can still stumble. Every single person here is a work in progress. None of us are a finished product. If I'm wrong, raise your hand. If there's somebody who's perfect here, I want to know how you did it. It's not me. And then when we look at Abraham's sin, we can see how he set himself up for failure. Some things that happened in his life that opened the door for sin. And I think if we reflect on this and we look in the mirror, we might see some ways that, you know what, I do the same thing. And maybe that's why I continue to struggle with sin. Now, the first thing we see here that set him up for a fall was that Abraham left where God had called him. See, Abraham's lie in chapter 20 has a whole lot more in common with chapter 12 than just a lie. In both instances, Abraham left where God had called him to be. Now, in chapter 12, it was because of the famine in the land. The text here in chapter 20 doesn't tell us why Abraham left, but it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination. Think of just what happened last week in the last chapter, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And if you remember, Abraham had prayed and begged and pleaded with God to spare these cities. But they weren't spared. Destruction on a massive scale, something that has affected the geography of the region still today, 4,000 years later. And then there was his nephew Lot and everything that happened to his family. It's a story of tragedy and scandal. And maybe it was just all too much for Abraham. He just needed a change of scenery, just needed to get away. But whatever the reason, Abraham left where God had called him to be and went someplace else. And I'm sure Abraham thought he had a good reason. I'm sure Abraham could have given you good justification. But the point is this, it doesn't really matter what his reason was. By leaving the place that God had called him to be, he was leaving the place of God's provision and God's protection over him. Abraham, that's not where I called you. That's not where you're supposed to be. Now, as we apply this to our own lives, we need to be clear on this, that we're not talking about a matter of geography. You know, for Abraham, this was a matter of you know, his physical address. For you, it probably won't be. But it can be about place. That we are literally someplace we shouldn't be, and that sets us up for failure. Think of the teenage girl that tells her parents that she is going over to her friend's house to spend the night. But that's not really where they are. They go someplace different. They're doing something that mom and dad probably wouldn't want them to be doing at some place they wouldn't want them to be. But while they're there, things get out of hand, get out of control, something unplanned happens, and boom, there's a big old mess. And later on, this girl was in tears, explained it to her mom and dad, I didn't mean for this to happen. I didn't plan on this. Yet she walked into it. She opened the door to it. Because she was in some place she wasn't supposed to be, doing something she wasn't supposed to be doing. And it can be a matter of place. Or I open with the story of the guy caught in the affair. Same thing happens there. Why was he having a Facebook relationship with this woman and he didn't tell his wife about it? He kept it hidden from her. Or why would a woman... It starts off just once a week. She goes out to dinner with a co-worker, keeps it from her husband, doesn't tell him about it. Soon it becomes twice a week. And next thing you know, they're involved with each other because she was someplace she wasn't supposed to be. The sin doesn't just happen. One of the biggest lies we tell ourselves, I don't know where that came from. It just happened. Sin rarely ever just happens. If we're truly honest with ourselves, if we're truly honest with God, we set the stage for it. We invite it in. We just happen to think we're the exception to all the rules and that it won't happen to us. But it does. But sometimes not being in the place God called us to be, we're not even talking about place at all. It's more about purpose. We're not doing the things we need to be doing to be in the place God wants us to be. And so we make ourselves vulnerable to temptation. We open ourselves to danger. If we go day after day after day and we never crack our Bibles, we spend hardly any time in prayer. We only come to church when we feel like it or we've got nothing else going on. We're not in the place of God's provision and protection. And so we are open to sin. So when we leave that place, we're bound to stumble. and bound to fall. Because we've left the place God's called us to be. Secondly, Abraham put himself in a bad position because he was putting himself first. He was thinking all about himself. Proverbs 16:18 says, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Abraham stumbles into this sin because he's only looking out for himself. Look at verses 9 through 11. Then Abimelech called Abraham in and said, what have you done to us? How have I wronged you that you brought such great guilt upon me and my kingdom? You have done things to me that should never be done. And Abimelech asked Abraham, what was your reason for doing this? And listen to Abraham's explanation here. Abraham replied, I said to myself, there is surely no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. And notice how in that one verse, how many times he uses me, myself, and I. It's all about him. And he was afraid of what might happen to him because of his wife's beauty. Now, this is a remarkable thing in and of itself because she's almost a 90-year-old woman at this point. I don't know what her beauty secret was. If you figure that out, you've made $1 million right there. And yes, I realize they lived longer back in the day, but even if you average out the lifespan, she's like the equivalent of a 56-year-old woman. And Abraham is concerned that the most powerful man in this area is going to want her for himself. But where's his concern for her? I mean, he's concerned about what will happen to him. You know, as a husband, wouldn't he be looking out for her, wanting to protect her? Where's the sense of chivalry here of wanting to protect her? But he wasn't thinking of her. He certainly wasn't thinking of Abimelech. He didn't mind putting Abimelech in a compromising situation. And he should have known what might happen. He saw what happened earlier in Egypt. But if you look carefully at the times in your own life where you stumble into the same old sin, you're going to find that almost every time you're putting yourself first. You're thinking of your own needs and your own wants first. And you're not considering the needs of others. And we do this in a variety of ways. Sometimes we just overestimate our willpower. We think too highly of our strength and our ability to say no. I won't fall into that. I'm more spiritual than that. Sometimes we just think we deserve it. We're that important. We're that good. But here's a tricky part. Thinking of yourself first doesn't always feel like pride. A lot of times when we stumble into sin, it happens at those times when we're thinking very poorly about ourselves. Or I'm moping around. Oh, woe is me. I'm no good. You know, we're going through this, what we call today, low self-esteem. And we're beating ourselves up. And that doesn't feel like pride. But if it's not pride, it's a very close cousin. Because let me tell you what they have in common. They're both all about me, myself, and I. They're all thinking of themselves first. Whether you're thinking, oh, I'm all that and more, or you're thinking, oh, I'm no good at all, you're still thinking about you all the time. And not considering the needs of others. And the cure of thinking less of yourself isn't to think highly of yourself. That's just to trade in one disease for another. The cure to thinking less of yourself is to think of yourself less. Nothing cures poor self-esteem like thinking of others first. You see, instead of looking down on yourself, you're looking up to serve others. And when you look up, you see the face of God. So if you're struggling with a particular sin in your life, carefully examine the attitudes that you have at the time. Your attitudes toward yourself and your attitudes toward others. Consider their needs first. Put them first. How does your sin affect them? What price do they pay? What position are you putting them in? What are their needs? We need to hear Paul's counsel in Philippians 2. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. And when you think of yourself less and put the needs of others first, it quickly steers you away from those things that cause you to fall into sin. So Abraham left where God had called him. Abraham was thinking of himself first. And finally, the reason he stumbles into sin here is because he was building on half-truths. When Abraham and Sarah told others that they were brother and sister, it wasn't a total lie. They had the same father. Now, I listen to me here. I know this sends our creepometer through the roof, okay? But this is before God gave the law to Moses, the law that prohibited this sort of marriage. And in ancient times, it was very common to marry within your own clan, your own tribe, even your own family. And so, technically, they were brother and sister, half brother and sister. But the lie here isn't in what they said, it's in what they left out. Look at the rest of Abraham's explanation to Abimelech in verses 12 and 13. He's talking to the king here. Besides, she really is my sister, the daughter of my father, though not of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God had me wander from my father's household, I said to her, this is how you can show your love to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother. And even though what they said was true, it was still a lie. It was a lie because it wasn't the whole truth. It was a lie because it was intended to deceive. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to tell everybody everything we know just to satisfy their idle curiosity. That's not being honest. That's just being a gossip. It's not the point. But if you are only telling part of the truth in order to deceive or create a false impression, if the information you are withholding is crucial for them to act appropriately, then you are lying and it is a sin. And a half-truth is never a solid foundation for righteousness. You can't build a righteous life on half-truth. I was reading an article this last week about hundreds of homeowners up in the Northeast, in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And they're all suffering from crumbling foundations. About 10 years after their homes were built, cracks begin to spider web through their basement walls and quickly begin crumbling. Some of them have had to leave their homes. They're no longer safe to live in. Fixing them is sometimes more expensive than what the house is worth. And so the state has sent people in. They begin to research this and investigate, trying to figure out what's going on with all of these foundations. And what they found is that every single one of these homes has one thing in common. All of them had their concrete supplied from a single supplier. Where's Gene at? That would be a nightmare, wouldn't it, Gene? But here's what they found. In this concrete, there is a single ingredient, something in the aggregate that they had pulled from their quarry to make the concrete, that has a chemical reaction with the soil in this area that causes the concrete to break down. And half-truths are like that one ingredient in the concrete. It looks good and solid at first, but it always cracks and breaks down, and it leaves us vulnerable to sin. And even when we would not fall victim to a total lie, I mean, if Satan came to us and he just had an out-and-out lie, we would like, no, Satan, you're not getting anywhere with that. We will fall victim to a half-truth. Because a half-truth sounds good. It can be defended in part with incontrovertible logic. It has the veneer of truth. but the heart of a lie. And it's so dangerous because if you remember, Jesus told us that Satan is the father of lies. And so a half-truth is nothing but a half-open door just left open for Satan to come in and do his worst. And when we begin building our lives, building our decisions based on half-truths, we have left the door open for Satan to come in and do his worst. Michelle had a problem stealing from her employer. It cost her a job. It cost her a marriage. And now it had cost her a second job. And now her second husband was having to pay tens of thousands of dollars to keep her out of jail. And it started with half-truths. They're not paying me enough. They don't treat me fairly. I need this. Over the years, though, these small half-truths led to more than $100,000 in embezzlement. See, a half-truth is still a complete lie. You can't build on half-truths because it's a foundation that will crumble beneath you. There's a sin in your life, and you have been struggling with that same sin for a long time. Maybe you're completely frustrated. You're at the end of your rope. Maybe you've just given up and decided, you know what? I'll never beat it. Doesn't matter anymore. But what I'm asking you to do this morning is don't just consider that sin. Don't isolate that sin from everything else going on in your life. But look at what happens in your life leading up to that sin, before that sin. Because 99 times out of 100, there is something that we are doing that sets us up for failure. We're walking into it. There is some way in our lives that we have left the place that God has called us to be. There's some way in our life where we are thinking of ourselves first, putting ourselves before the needs of others. And we're fooling ourselves with half-truths. Many times the key to overcoming a sin is not defeating that sin itself, but it's changing the things that lead to that sin. So maybe there is some real honest examination that needs to happen with yourself, maybe with some friends or loved ones, definitely with God, about the things that you do to leave your life open to sin. Something for us to consider as we, in just a few moments, sing our song of invitation and commitment. What am I doing to leave myself open to this? Let me just give you three questions we need to ask this morning. Number one, am I where God wants me to be? And this is a question of place and purpose. And if you find yourself in a place doing something, imagine this. If Jesus just suddenly showed up. And Jesus suddenly showed up, would you be cool with that? Oh, hey, Lord, come over, have a seat, let's talk. Or would you be all embarrassed, like, oh, didn't expect to see you here. Trying to hide what's going on. Well, I'm not usually here, Lord. I'm not usually doing this. Realization, though, Jesus is already there. But if you'd be embarrassed if he showed up physically, that's probably a good sign that, you know what, I'm not in the place and I'm not in the purpose God wants me to be. Question number two, am I considering the needs of others or am I thinking only of myself? Because when you put yourself first, you won't make the best decisions. Question number three, am I walking in truth? Half-truths are a slippery slope that will cause you to fall every time. But honesty and integrity will keep you on firm ground. But when it comes to defeating sin in our lives, the main thing we need to realize is this. You can't defeat the sin in your life. Not on your own. That's what the whole point of the cross was to begin with. Is that we can't overcome sin by our own power. And I don't know why it is that after we become Christians that we think suddenly we become Superman or Batman. You pick your favorite superhero. I don't care. But we think, I can do it on my own now. I can do it by the strength of my own willpower. I can fight it on my own. No, you can't. And why are we trying to defeat something that Jesus has already defeated? He's already fought the battle. He's already won it. We just need to live out that victory in our lives. The problem is we want God to give us the victory in some sort of real easy, simple solution. It's like the guy that was praying, Lord, just take this evil desire from me. I'd never sin again if God just took all bad desires from me. That'd be easy. That's not how God's wanting to work in my life. He wants me to make Him Lord. He wants me to give Him the number one position in my life. And we need to turn it all over to Him. And so as we close this service this morning, maybe there's some rearranging of priorities that need to be taken place in your life. Moving yourself down the ladder a few notches, moving God up a few notches. Not trying to overcome your sin by your own willpower, but by going to the cross and looking to the cross and receiving the victory that He has already achieved for you. Please stand as we sing this song. And if the Spirit is speaking to you this morning, calling on you to make a decision, to come to Him, to turn from your sin, please listen and respond. Let's sing together. Giving.